Good morning. It's great to see you. Wonderful to be with you. Want to say a special welcome to all the students out there who are finishing up spring break today. I want you to know we know because of the snow days that the teachers are piling it on, and we believe that you can make it through the next 9 weeks. And I want you to say a special welcome to all the parents today who figured out how to navigate spring break. You made it. Congratulations. We're very proud of you as well. Glad to see everybody on this St. Patrick's Day, and we're thankful that we have this opportunity to continue to talk about the Gospel of Luke, and particularly what we learn about Christ from the Gospel of Luke. This series has been called Friends in Low Places, because we learn that if we're going to accept Christ, we're going to learn to accept him in a low place, in the valleys of our humility, not the mountaintops of our pride. He might encounter us up there, but if we're going to hang with him, we're going to have to travel down to the valley. And we find in Luke that that's the people he likes, the people in the valleys, the least, the last, the lost. And so today we want to learn how we can encounter him. And we're calling this the Last Supper You'd Expect. We all know about the Last Supper, right? It's that time when they all got together for the big dinner and they all sat on the same side of the table. You remember that one? I'm sure it wasn't awkward. Actually, we do know a little bit about how big dinners like that worked. They actually sat at a U-shaped table, so they were kind of on the same side. It was U-shaped so the server could come in to the middle of it. But we're not just talking about the Last Supper, and we're not just having communion today. In fact, we're not even going to have communion because we want to talk about something. Great. It's a great thing. We encounter God through it. It's a gift. We're told to do it. But we're going to look at why Jesus had dinner with people and the totality of the purpose, which is actually communion, not the ritual with the bread and the juice, but communion with God is why Jesus had dinner. In our culture, we're used to, if someone comes up to you and they call you on the phone and they say, hey, we'd like you to come to a restaurant. We have a free dinner for you. What are they trying to do? Sell you something. It's not free. You're going to pay with your time, right? For Jesus, it's not like that. Jesus didn't call people up and say, hey, I want to have dinner with you. Jesus taught people, and the point of his teaching was in order to have dinner. Dinner wasn't a tool. It was the point. It was the point that you were part of his family, because who do you eat with? You eat with your family. Who are the people you're most connected to? They're the people at your family dinner table. That was the point for Jesus. Jesus wanted to be a part of your family. Jesus wanted you to be a part of his family. And he invites some of the last people you'd expect there. In fact, these meals take place in very strange ways. And I'm thankful he invites people you wouldn't expect. People who are just trying. A lot of us in life, we're just trying, right? We're trying hard, and we recognize there's a lot about God that we don't get right. There's a lot about the great mystery of God that the few pounds of gray matter in between our ears, it just can't manage. I have studied every major Christian tradition and denomination. I have studied every major world religion. And I can tell you, I wouldn't be a United Methodist if I didn't think the doctrines and the standards and the beliefs and the policies and procedures were the closest to what we can tell from this life is the truth about God. What we can tell from the Bible is the truth about God. But I can also tell you that there are plenty of people just as smart as me who have looked at it and have said, well, I see it, and just as faithful to Christ as me, who say, well, I see it a little different. And I can also tell you that no matter which ones of us are the closest to correct in our actual beliefs, when we get up to heaven, God's going to look down, you know, and we're going to realize, man, there was a lot we didn't have a clue about. And I'm sure God looks down at us often and goes, oh, they're just trying, right? They're trying. And Jesus ate with some funny people, some people that others in the world didn't think were trying, but Jesus looked at them and said, they're trying. And I'm thankful, because that's all any of us can bring to Jesus is we were trying. All of us have stories where he encountered us when we weren't trying very well, but we were trying. I grew up in my elementary and middle school years at Fountain City United Methodist Church on the north side of town. And the church there, we were, the group of guys I was with in my grade, we were infamous. We retired most of the Sunday school teachers who taught us. There was a lot of drama. We had a fist fight one day in class. There was a bloody nose, and we were all friends. It's just, you ever had a group of young people and like they're all okay on their own, but you get them together and it's crazy town. That's who we were. And so one day, the children's director, who'd lost so many Sunday school teachers because of us, on this great and glorious day, she came to the youth director and she said, they're sixth graders now. They're all yours. You take them. And one of the places the youth director had to take us was to Gatlinburg for resurrection, for the big youth. Yeah, it was actually going on when I was young. And they took us. And they took us to a session, and bless our 12-year-old hearts, we were trying. And we probably related to the message more than most sixth graders because we had more to repent for. And so we go, and we learn about communion. And we hear about communion, and then they brought us back to our rooms, and they had a time where like all the counselors had to leave the room to go have a staff meeting. And they left us for like 5 minutes, big mistake. They come back and we are celebrating communion in our room with Cheetos and Dr. Pepper. And the youth director sees his job flash before his eyes. He's like, a pastor's gonna find out we had communion with Cheetos and Dr. Pepper, and there's so much wrong with that theologically. And it was officiated by sixth grade boys, and I'm going to sell insurance. This is not my church career over. And I hear, actually, after they came in and they said, "Hey guys, let's do this a little different." They had that, and then I hear through the wall the youth director talking to one of the volunteers, and he said, "Oh my goodness, what are we going to do?" And the volunteers go, you know what? This is great. This is actually, those boys were trying. I know they don't know. I know they can't put the right shoe on the right foot yet, but they were trying. We can work with this. And Jesus looks at so many people that the rest of us go, oh my gosh, we don't know what to do with these folks. And Jesus goes, no, you know what? You know what? I can work with this. I just want to have dinner with them. So I know some of you come today, and I know some of you got major questions about God and major questions about church. And some of you come today and in the name of Jesus, you've heard awful things said and you've seen awful things done. And you've got all these questions of how can this even be? So I want us to go back to the very basics today of who Jesus is. And I want us to go back to one of the most basic questions, because most of the time when we talk about religion, we talk about God in our society, we talk about a particular church or a particular religion, and we pick apart what they do. And that's all well and good. We need to be careful about what we do. We need to study it and try to do the most faithful things. But I want us to go back to the most foundational question in life. And it's this, the most important question is not, does the church get Jesus right? It's, does Jesus get God right? Does Jesus get God right? And if Jesus gets God right, then what that means is that following Jesus or not is the most important decision we'll ever make. And that at any moment in our lives, how we are following him or not following him is the most important thing in our lives. And we can figure everything else out from there. Now, if Jesus doesn't get God right, then maybe do religion when you feel like it, maybe don't. But if Jesus gets God right, then it's the most important thing for each of us at all times. And we've got to be reminded of what Jesus actually said. We've got to be reminded of what Jesus actually taught about God, because on our own, we won't actually naturally gravitate to that. We'll gravitate to people who say that Jesus said things that we already believe. And we will take the part that Jesus said that are easy for us to follow, and we will say that's the totality of who Jesus is. And then we'll take the parts that are hard for us to follow, and we'll say, you know what, he didn't really mean that. or not like it sounds. And we'll just kind of push those to the side because that's what we do. That's human nature. That's maybe our sinful nature within us. But we sang about Jesus saving our soul. And it's the real Jesus, the whole Jesus that saves us. And it's the whole Jesus, not the half Jesus, that's worth following. This is why we ask you every week to be a part of the Bible reading plan that you can find at concordunited.org/Bible or at the information center, a printout. Be a part of the daily devotions that you can get on email or podcast at concordunited.org/Bible because we want you daily going back to the real Jesus, the whole Jesus. Go back to the original sources who walked the earth with him and see what he said and see what he did for yourself and then pray to him and let him talk to you. Because this crazy thing happens when you pray to God because you think, I don't have time. And then you start making time and you start thinking, oh, I felt better today. And then you keep praying and God sometimes speaks back. It's the darndest thing. Sometimes, even if you're not hardly listening, God will speak back. And it's amazing. So today, we're looking at two times when Jesus had dinner with people. And we're looking at what it teaches us about what Jesus taught about God. We're going to ask ourselves if Jesus got God right. And then we're going to ask ourselves, what does that mean for us? We begin just very shortly before Jesus goes to Jerusalem and has that famous Last Supper. He goes through a town named Jericho. And he encounters a man named Zacchaeus. And if you grew up in church, you sang a song about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a wee little man was he. And someday, you're going to get to heaven, and you're going to meet Zacchaeus, and he's going to go, you need to apologize for that song. I didn't like it a bit, right? Maybe now that he's sanctified in heaven, he's like, okay, it's helping people grow closer to Christ. Or maybe he sits up there and demands an apology from all of us as we walk through the door. Or the gates. I don't know. I don't know. But he was this short guy, but he was a powerful person. He was a person who had some connections, knew how to get his way in where he wanted to be because he was a tax collector. Now, if you were a tax collector in those days, you were Jewish, but you worked for the Roman government because they didn't want to send their own person. You might beat up their own person, but they didn't think that you'd do that to one of their own. So they had one of your own who would be tax collector. And the tax collectors worked off commission. They charged you extra for your taxes, and that was their salary. And the commission wasn't firmly, universally set at a certain percentage, so they could change it. So as you can imagine, they weren't well-liked. That people always thought they were getting ripped off, even if it was a fair commission. And from what we can tell of Zacchaeus, it wasn't always a fair commission. It wasn't a fair commission because if you were a tax collector, you were supposed to be like upper middle class. He was upper class. He was upper class. And so he was kind of known as charging too much. And maybe he just got tired of people making fun of him for his height. And he's like, I want to stick it to you, right? I'm going to become a tax collector. Every time you told me I was short when I was a kid, yeah, that's another denarii. Whatever a denarii, well, actually a denarii was a day's wage back then. So here's Zacchaeus. And Jesus comes to town. And everybody wants to see Jesus, so does Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus can't see over everybody, and so he climbs a tree. And here comes Jesus, and Jesus comes in, and Jesus looks up in the tree, and he calls him by name. And people might think, well, how do you know his name? And then they think, oh my gosh, he knows who this is. Why does he know this person? And then they're like, okay, Jesus is going to let him have it. Jesus is going to let Zacchaeus have it. And what does Jesus say? I want to come to your house for dinner. Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house for dinner. And Jesus could have gone to anybody's house, right? He could, and there were wonderful people who were salt of the earth. And Jesus could have gone to their house and it would teach everybody, hey, be like them. There were families with sick children. And people, Jesus could have gone and hung out with all the children from Children's Hospital. He had all kinds of things he could have done, and he went to Zacchaeus' home. And people are offended. If the governor came to town, and the governor came to town and was going to have dinner here in Farragut, and he goes and hangs out with the folks who run the CBD store, right? you're going to go, what is that? Or CDB, I don't know. I don't go to that store. But that's how people felt about this. And then what happens? Something major happens at that dinner. I want to read to you about it. This is from Luke. This is Luke 19. We're picking up with verse 7. All who saw it began to grumble. They said, Jesus has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner. Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, look, half of my possessions, Lord, I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much. Then Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and save the lost. Now, what happened right here? Something major changed in Zacchaeus' life. I mean, something big time changed, because he made a major financial decision on the spot that was going to take his net worth down, that he was going to give back a lot of what he'd earned to the poor, and that if he defrauded anybody, he was going to pay them four times as much. And you don't make decisions like that likely, and you certainly don't make decisions like that quickly, unless something big has gone on in your life and in your heart, and something had big. In fact, one of the only things big enough to make you make one of those decisions, and it's this. Zacchaeus came into that meeting. Zacchaeus knew he was a scoundrel. And Zacchaeus felt unworthy to approach God. And he learned that he was worthy. He learned that he was worthy. And the reason he learned he was worthy wasn't because of what he'd done. Maybe in his heart of hearts he was trying, but he wasn't trying very well. It was what Jesus did for him that he discovered that because of what Jesus had done for him, he was now worthy to approach God. You might have people like that. And if you've had people like that in your life, you know the difference it makes. I had a lady in our church, a very successful professional, and she came up to me and she said, I gave a lot of money back to my public high school. Why'd you do that? Because back in those days, they didn't encourage girls to go to science classes. And I had a teacher, and I love science, and I had a teacher who saw something in me. So I helped fund a new science lab for that school, because something changed, because even she inside herself had been made to feel like she wasn't worthy. Somebody made her feel worthy, and it changes you, and it causes you to make these big decisions because you want to share that, and that's what happens with Zacchaeus. So the first question we want to ask about Jesus and what Jesus teaches us about God, is Jesus right that you are worthy to approach God? Is Jesus right that you are actually worthy to approach God? Not what you've done, but because Jesus gave his life for you. Because Jesus looked at you and all the ways you're trying and the ways you're not trying very well. And Jesus said, I'd give my life for them. The way Jesus looked at Zacchaeus and said, I'm willing to let everybody else in town hate me just because this person, just to show this person they're loved because nobody else is loving them. And because I see something in this person. Jesus looks at you like that. And it's funny how many of us have those stories about not feeling worthy to come to church. You'd be amazed how often we have stories about, I didn't feel worthy to come to church. I thought lightning was going to strike when I walked through the doors. And it's people you'd never think, right? It's almost all of us. In fact, if you don't have one of those stories, you probably will eventually. But here's what happens. We're very good at judging books by their covers. In fact, we're so good at judging a book by their cover that if you write a book, the number one thing your publisher will say is, we want the right to veto any cover and any title idea that you have. Because if you don't get the cover and the title right, nobody will buy the book. That's how we work. And we look at people and we judge books by their covers. And sometimes we come into church and we see people, and we see a man who's dressed up real nice in a suit with a tie. We see a family, and all the kids have their hair combed, like, to perfection, And we just think, oh my gosh, those people have it together. They never have problems. Or maybe it's the opposite way for you. Maybe you come to church, and you're all dressed up, and you see somebody show up in jeans and a hoodie. I don't think young people wear jeans anymore, which hurts my heart as a child of the 80s who like wore nothing but denim for 5 years. But we see somebody come casual and we're like, look how confident they are. I couldn't come. I'm not confident enough to come to church like that. Whatever it is. Or we see somebody drive up and we look at the nice vehicle that they come in and we just say, oh, those people don't have problems and they've always felt worthy to come to church. They wouldn't accept me if they knew who I was. Or we look at people and they just have that gift of being gracious and they just always know what to say, right, in social settings. And maybe you don't always know what to say in social settings and you feel awkward sometimes socially. Or we see how people are respected for their position in the community or in school or how they make the grade or make the team or get to sing the solo. We see all that. And we say, oh, they're good. I don't know if I'm good enough. And the funny thing is, they probably have a not worthy story as well. They probably also have a story of coming in and feeling not worthy. And so many times, people I would never expect come and say, I didn't feel worthy, but I gave church a try. And you know, this person spoke to me. And they smiled at me and they were happy to see me. And they even offered to sit next to me in worship. And so I decided maybe I would stay. And I stayed and I heard that the message that was preached at church, it was this God who accepts people who don't feel worthy. And I thought, well, maybe this could be a place for me too. And then I kept coming back and I kept coming back. And somehow this place became a home. You would not believe how many people have that story. We had one lady, and she was at a previous church I served, and she came from a very difficult background where she had been through a lot of challenges that many of us have not had to face. And one of the challenges from the way she was raised, she used a different, I will call it grammar, than we often use in church when she spoke. And she had this amazing, beautiful testimony. And she said, Pastor Will, this church has made such a difference for me. I've been a Christian for about a year now. Can I please share my story with the church? And it was this beautiful story. And I said, yes, absolutely. Here's the thing. I want you to write it out and I want you to come share it with me first. And then we're going to go over it and then you can share it with the church. So she did, and it was beautiful and it was wonderful. And she began speaking and we all had tears in our eyes. It was just great. But then as she's talking, as Daniel Doubleday earlier, you know, talked about the Spirit moving. Well, the Spirit began moving and she went off script. And she was speaking from her heart, but when she went off script, she went back to some grammar that she'd learned earlier in her life. And she said, you know, I never thought I'd feel welcome at the church, because all you other ladies at the church, you come to church and your outfits have the perfect accessories. And you wake up each morning going, how can I get the right accessories for my outfit for church today? And I wake up this morning just wanting to get my to church. And what her my was the first part of the word accessory. And so I'm sitting there going, this is beautiful. This is actually gospel. And all the young parents with children are going to be mad at me. And I'm going to go hide in my office rather than shake hands today. We come and we have all these reasons that we feel not worthy. And everybody else does too. Right? Because when you really get to know the Jesus of the Gospels, you see that none of us are. You see that we're all just beggars telling other beggars where to get bread. That's how we all are. So I want you to ask yourself the question, is Jesus right that you're actually worthy because of what Jesus has done, not because of how good or how not good you are? Now we want to go back and we want to go fast forward a little bit. And we're going to fast forward. Jesus continued to travel. He went through Jericho. He ends up in Jerusalem. And there in Jerusalem, he goes into the temple. He turns over the tables. He tells them to get their act together. He teaches and preaches in the temple. And then he comes to this evening where he's having dinner. And while he's having dinner, a mob is forming and guards are planning his arrest. But right then he's having dinner with his disciples. And he says, hey, guys like you, I've wanted to share this meal with you. This is the point of it all. And even as he's sharing that with them, one of the guys at that meal is planning to betray him. And the others don't have him figured out at all. Because this is right after he says, this is my body, this is my blood, this amazing meal. This is the conversation that his disciples have right after this. And this we pick up with Luke chapter 22, beginning with verse 24. A dispute arose among the disciples as to which one was regarded as the greatest. Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. Not so with you. Rather, the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you, just as my Father has conferred on me, a kingdom, so that you may eat and drink at my table and in my kingdom, and you will sit on the thrones of judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Simon, Simon, listen. Remember, Simon is Simon Peter. He goes on to say, Simon, Simon, listen. Satan has demanded to sift all of you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your own faith may not fail, and you, when once you have turned back, will strengthen your brothers. And he said, Peter said to Jesus, Lord, I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death. Jesus said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow three times this day till you deny me three times that you knew me. Think about that. He has this meal. This is what he's wanted, this meal. And he knows. He knows they don't understand well yet. They're thinking about themselves. I mean, how arrogant. They're still thinking, because he's told them, remember at the meal, he's like, I won't celebrate this with you again until I do so in my kingdom. They're like, he's going to become king. Like, we're going to be generals. We're going to be secretary of state. We're going to be over the Department of the Interior. We're going to be the cabinet. He's going to lift us up. We're going to have the good life. We're going to have power. And it's a different type of kingdom than they can see yet. And they're worried about who's the best. Who gets, you know, the most airtime? Who gets the most respect among us? And Jesus looks and he says, that's not it. He said, actually, I haven't given up on you. You're going to be judges over the 12 tribes of Israel. It's just going to look very different than what you think it looks like. He doesn't give up on them. So I want to ask you this question about Jesus and God. Is Jesus right that God does not give up on you because of your selfish motivations and your cowardly actions? Is Jesus actually right about that? Because if Jesus is right about that, it changes a lot for us, because we all have things that we don't want to confess, because we have selfish motivations and cowardly actions that nobody else actually knows how selfish they are and how cowardly they are than us. Just like those disciples were selfish. Just like Peter was cowardly, like he was going to deny his best friend three times in the most public of settings. We've got that. We've got those things. We don't want anybody to know the actual motivation behind why we did certain things. We don't want them to know how much we wanted to acquire something and how we might have actually bent the rules in our favor to get it and bent the rules in somebody else's disfavor in order to get it. We don't want them to know that. We don't want people to know all the times when we saw a situation and someone was in trouble and we could have helped and we kind of shied away and pretended not to see. We don't want all that. But we know, we haven't forgotten. And when we walk into church, sometimes we wonder, does this disqualify me? Is Jesus right? Is Jesus right that does not disqualify you, that God has not given up on you because of that? And in fact, God wants to redeem and to use that. God used Peter's denial so that one day Peter would have the courage to follow him unto death. Peter didn't lie when he said, I will follow you to prison and to death. Peter just wasn't ready yet. But one day he'd be that strong. Those disciples who were arrogant and who were selfish, it wasn't incorrect to say that they were selfless servants, or on their way to that most of them gave up their lives for Christ. Most of them gave up their standing in the community and everything they had. They just weren't ready yet, but Jesus saw it in them. So then there's a third and final question about Jesus' picture of God. Is Jesus right that God is calling you to serve others? Is Jesus right that you have a calling in your life to go out there and to serve others? That we talk about sometimes, like pastors who preach, oh, you have a calling. Or musicians who sing, you know, they have a calling. Or you go to a Bible study and the Bible study teacher, you're like, you have a real calling. For every one of us has a calling. It might look a little different, but if you're alive and you have breath in your lungs, then not only does Jesus love you, not only does Jesus want to forgive you, not only does Jesus want to save you, Jesus wants to call you, and he has a calling. And the question is not, do you have a calling? It's, will you answer it? And will you seek him and seek his calling for your life? And if he's actually right about God, then that's the most important question you'll ever answer is, will I commune with him? Will I relate to him? Will I answer that calling to go and to serve others? And he uses the craziest people. Today we're, you know, it's St. Patrick's Day. And some of you wore your green and some of you didn't. And if you didn't, you're lucky because, you know, some of us went to school, you didn't wear green, like you'd come home with pinch marks on your arms. And today they've passed rules against that. You know, we're more aware of personal space today, so we just socially shame each other for not wearing green because that's better, right? Well, some of you don't know who St. Patrick is. We think he lived in around the 300s AD, and he was a young man who lived in Britain. And back then, there weren't just pirates of the Caribbean. There were pirates of the British Isles. And a pirate ship came to the coastal city where he lived, and they captured him, and they took him over to Ireland as a slave. He spent 6 years in Ireland as a slave before escaping, hopped a boat back to Britain, got his life back, had to decide what to do, decided to be a priest, went to whatever seminary looked like back then, became a priest, and then they said, "Now, where do you want to go serve?" And he says, "Ireland." And they said, "But Ireland is full of pagans." And he said, "I know, that's why I want to go there. I know because I have this calling, because I know their culture, because I've seen it. And instead of allowing my slavery to make me hateful in my heart forever towards my enslavers, this God who set me free from the slavery of sin has caused me to want to go and share this amazing gospel with them." And that's why we remember St. Patrick, because he answered that call. You might have a call like that. You might have experienced a time in your life where you felt enslaved, but God's going to bring you out into something very different. Now I want to share with you the point of it all. We're going back just before that, the conversations we just read, is Jesus's time at what we call the Last Supper. So we're picking up, we're going back, Luke 22, verse 14. "When the hour came, he took his place at the table and the apostles with him. He said to them, I've eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he said, 'Take and divide this among yourself. For I tell you that from now on I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes.' Then he took a loaf of bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' And he did the same with the cup after supper, saying, 'The cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood.'" What's he doing at this dinner table? Who comes to the dinner table? It's the family. He's telling them they're a part of the family. This is his meal. It's actually him, his body, his blood. He's saying, "You're part of my family now." And the final question, is Jesus right that God is inviting you to be part of a new family called church? Because here's what happens. If you accept Jesus, but you decide to go at it on your own, what will happen eventually is you'll do what we talked about earlier. If you just try to follow Jesus on your own without becoming a part of the family that Jesus created for you to be a part of called church, then you will take the parts of Jesus you like and you will leave the others and you will add into your vision of Jesus your own prejudices and your own hatreds and your own soapboxes and the things that you like and that you enjoy, and you'll clone Jesus in your image. But that's not how it works. We're created in his, right? And we find our true selves when we allow him to live through us. We hear this a lot, and I want to tell you, you're going to hear a lot of this year as we go through an election cycle in our country. And I encourage you, I'm not one of those people who says don't have political conversations. I think the fact that we have the freedom to have political conversations is an amazing gift that people fought and they bled and they died for, and we should appreciate that and respect it and engage and be involved, and that's wonderful. Here's what I'm going to ask you. Do so in such a way that the people that you talk to about your political convictions, that instead of leaving going, "Well, so-and-so seems to think they have it all figured out," or so-and-so says that everybody at their church thinks this way, by the way, they don't. Leave in such a way that people, maybe they know your opinions now, but that what impresses them is that they go, "You know, I think that person, I think, you know, when I talk to Bob or when I talk to Nancy, and if your name's Bob or Nancy, I'm sorry. I tried to pick a name that I wasn't aware of a couple that are both named this. But where they go, you know, I think what disturbs them most about politics isn't that they're judgmental of our politicians, because it's easy to sit back and be a critic. And there are those things that we think, oh, that's just wrong, I'd do it differently. But what I think what disturbs them the most is the vision Jesus gives for society and how far they are from being able to fully figure out all that that means. Because I can tell you, you know, there have been plenty of sincere Christians who I've disagreed with politically. And if I was king for a day, one thing I know for sure, I couldn't fix everything. I wouldn't know how to. I've spent my life studying Jesus, and I can still tell you his ways are so much higher than mine. There's so much ideas that he had that I don't know how to implement, but I know I need his help just to live halfway faithfully each day. I know I'm desperate for him, or I don't have a chance. So is Jesus calling you to be a part of this thing called church, this new family, where you'll have a community to help you, and where you can help others who come in and don't feel worthy, and you can show them the love of God, and we can all take our ideas, some of which are wrong and some of which are right, and we can grow closer to God as we support one another in what it means to live faithfully? And if this is true, then what I want to say to you is, then I know there's no perfect church, but find a church where your conscience can accept, where you can serve others. And I'm very selfish. I want you to find Concord United Methodist Church. But more than that, I want you to find a church that your conscience can accept, where you can serve others. And if you can do that, if your church, you won't agree with everything with any church. The United Methodist social principles are this long. I guarantee you, if you read every one of them, there will be one you disagree with. There'll probably be more. But find a church your conscience can accept, where you can serve others. Your conscience can accept the doctrine about God. Your conscience can accept the ethics about life, and the way church is done. And then go there and serve others. And if you do that, you might just find that in doing that, you've accepted this invitation of Jesus to have dinner with him and serve him, to be a part of a community that helps other people see they're worthy, not because of what we've done, but because of what he's done. So he can look down at you and say, I just love him. I just love her. I just love him. They're trying. They're trying. If, as we close today, this is my prayer, that you would go and you would try, and you would try not on your own power, but you try on Jesus' power. So the prayer we're going to close with today is the prayer of St. Patrick, because it's one of the most beautiful prayers in the Christian tradition, because it talks about all the ways we need Christ. And I'm not going to list the whole prayer, because let me tell you, if you think my sermon's long, you should hear St. Patrick pray. You know, he can go for a while, but you're going to get the conclusion of his prayer today. Let's pray together. Christ, be with me. Christ, within me. Christ behind me, Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to win me, Christ to comfort and restore me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ in quiet, Christ in danger, Christ in hearts of all that love me, Christ in mouth of friend and stranger. I bind unto myself today the strong name of Trinity, the three in one and one in three, of whom all nature hath creation, Eternal Father, Spirit, Word, praise to the Lord of my salvation. Salvation is of Christ the Lord. Amen.